You're listening to the Master Passive Income Podcast Network.
Everyone loves a sexy story about finding hidden off-market gems, but are we chasing unicorns? This week, we dismantle the off-market myth. I explain why on-market doesn't mean overpriced and how lazy underwriting is the real issue, not the listing status. If you're tired of fairy tales and ready to source deals like a pro, this one's for you.
Welcome to the Real Escape Investing Podcast, where we guide you to escape the constraints of time, geography, and finance through real estate. And now, here's your host, Terry Schauer.
Hey, real estate fans, I have exciting news to share with you. Our monthly in-person networking events are back. If you're in the Montreal area, and even if you're not, go ahead and grab a ticket for our next event at equitybuildersclub.com/events. I would love to see you out.
Hey, real estate peeps. So this week, I'm doing an episode that's staying on our same topic, which is our theme right now, that is finding good deals and how to create deals, how to build deals in this market that is supposed to be way too competitive. And what I'm trying to do over the next 4 weeks is to give you some insight in some of the most effective ways to locate deals, build deals, and to really bust the myth that there are no good deals out there anymore. And this is going to culminate in our next networking event on June 17th. We also have a webinar running on June 16th with the same topic. If you can't make it and join us in person, you can go ahead and register for the webinar on the equitybuildersclub.com website /events. You will find the free June 16th webinar there. So I'm going to be tying all of this cool knowledge into those two events, the webinar and then the in-person networking event, to deliver some of this content. But today we're going to talk about the off-market myth. And what I want to do is to really get into some of those limiting beliefs again and to just call BS on some of them. And so there's, you know, kind of this lore, this belief in real estate world that the only good deals that you can do on investment properties are off markets, or that there's this kind of off market unicorn. And a lot of the time, you know, people who are getting started in the investing field have this belief that everything that's traded on market is overpriced, and that there's this kind of like secret underworld going on of amazing deals that are taking place that nobody else has access to. So I want to just demystify that a little bit. And I will also just remind the listener that I am sitting in my home in Montreal, Quebec, in Canada, and that our market up here in Canada obeys somewhat different laws to in the US. So unfortunately, if you're an American listener, some of this stuff might not be as applicable to you, just because the Canadian market, I would like to say, is perhaps more efficient than the American market, in the sense that there's not as many distressed properties, not as many, you know, wholesale opportunities. It's just a market that is, I guess, trading more efficiently and really according to the actual price, partly because of the fact that our price tags are so high. But we'll kind of get into this. So what I want to do is to just start out with the concept of market efficiency. And so, like, what is market efficiency? It really has to do with how close to actual market value objects are trading. And before we tie this specifically to real estate, let's talk about the used car market, for example. So in the used car market, whether you're going to a dealership and you're trying to buy a used car off the lot, whether you're trying to get it from an auction, or whether you're buying it on Facebook Marketplace or whatever trading site you're using for a car, it's, you know, difficult to think that you are going to, like, let's say, you know, I don't know cars that well, but let's say we have, like, you know, a 2005 Toyota Corolla, and that thing is really worth $3,000. If you see it somewhere listed for $1,000, like, chances are that that might look like a good deal, but something is probably off with it. And so the efficiency of a market just has to do with how close to that $3,000 price are those cars trading? And are there these pockets within your market, whether they're, you know, the scrapyard or somewhere in the country or someplace where that market efficiency has not reached. And so you're able to do these crazy deals if somehow you're able to beat it. And so like what I would say with, you know, our market in Quebec, in Canada, is our real estate market is really quite efficient. And so to even hear anecdotally of crazy deals that were done where something was bought at like 20% below market value, like that's a pretty rare situation. And I would say that goes for what happens on market and what happens off market with some specific caveats. And so what I want to do in this episode is to kind of like go through when we say off market, what do we actually mean by that? Because I think there are different ways in which something can be off market. So like maybe let's start with this very simplest thing of like, what's the definition of something being on market? So being on market means that it's listed on the MLS, on Centris, and probably there is a listing broker who has listed that property and it is placed on that database for everyone to see. And so that is what the conventional definition of on market is that it's listed by a realtor on the MLS. Okay, very simple on market deal. Now, if we go to the next thing, which is like, is the next level of on market would be what's called a pocket listing. And so certain brokers, when they have a client who wants to liquidate a property, will have what's called a pocket listing. And so the way that the pocket listing works is that often the broker will not be charging their full 4%. So probably the broker will be taking, you know, a 2% fee, let's hope, but then they're trying to save their client money. Maybe the client hopes that they're going to save money. And so that broker will then shop that pocket listing. It's not really a true off market. It's a pocket listing around to their network. Now, there are a few things that I don't like about this, and I'm going to just explain them to you from one investor to another. And that is that the way that things work with pocket listings is that typically the broker who has that pocket listing wants to just control the whole transaction. And whether that means that because they get to represent the seller and the buyer has no like other broker that's acting as their intermediary, it allows them to control that transaction to a greater degree. It also allows them to keep the full commission for themselves. And so my problem with this is actually twofold. The first one is that I feel like the client, so the seller in this case, is probably not getting the best deal or the best price that they could get than if something was listed on market, because very clearly, like that broker, their network is going to be smaller than everyone who might see the property on MLS. And so what this really turns on is if the seller is going to be able to save that additional 2% fee. So hopefully that pocket listing broker is only taking a 2% fee. If you agree as a seller to deal with a broker who proposes you that pocket listing scheme, you better be doing it for 2% and not 4%, because otherwise it's just like a way to manage to keep the whole commission and potentially not give you the best possible price. So that's one case where people will have pocket listings. The other one is like when something's a little bit off with the seller, and Lord knows I've been in this situation often enough where a broker will approach me and be like, oh, look, Terry, I have this pocket listing, but the seller's a little bit funny. And then what the situation that ends up generating is that like the seller, there's a reason why a seller doesn't want to put something on the MLS. And whether that's because, you know, either they're trying to get away with like not doing phase one environmentals, or they don't want to have to do a seller's declaration, or like whatever it is, there's like something that makes it that they don't want to do that, or else they've got some kind of weird relationship with their tenants and like they're a little bit paranoid. And like I've actually done two transactions like that in my career for, you know, with partners where the seller was like so paranoid that they didn't want the tenants to know they were selling. So like when we went to visit the building, we had to pretend we were like from the insurance company or something. And the whole transaction just ended up being really polluted and contaminated by the fact that that seller was like so paranoid and weird. And that then even like, you know, after the sale, because there's always moments at which you kind of need to like get that seller's information, whether it's to do utility transitions or whatever it is, like it was just really difficult from start to finish. So that's aspect number one, is that like some of those like pocket listings, it's because the seller is really special, because when someone doesn't want a property to hit the MLS, like either they're paranoid or they're trying to hide something. And then the other thing is having to deal with that broker who has the pocket listing. And so at this point in my career, I've, you know, done a lot of deals, and I have a broker who represents me as a buyer who I absolutely love to deal with. And so it's just such a more pleasant situation for me to be represented by a broker that I have a high level of trust in, and to have someone representing me, the buyer, in a transaction who's really looking out for my best interest in that deal. But when you're dealing with the pocket listing, what ends up happening is you have to talk directly to the seller's broker. And like, typically people who are shopping around pocket listings already, you know, in terms of their broker ethics, when I'm thinking about this, I'm already thinking, well, that's, they're maybe not serving their client in the best way possible, because the client will get the best price when something is listed on the open market. So why are they not listing on the open market? And then, you know, there is a whole range of level of competence and also level of just enjoyable, someone being enjoyable to deal with, that exists in the real estate world. And like, somebody who specializes in pocket listings might not necessarily be the kind of broker who it's the most fun and easy to deal with on a transaction. And, you know, anecdotally, some of those pocket listings have been really very unpleasant situations because of the intermediate broker really was not very pleasant to deal with. And like, in the end, the deal that was done as a result at the end of it was probably at the exact same market metrics that it would have been had I done those deals on Centris. So like, for the pleasure of having to deal with a paranoid seller and a broker who has a pocket listing who's complicated, like, ultimately I didn't beat the market at all on those deals. So I just want that, you know, not to say that you can never do something good with a pocket listing, but like, if there's a broker intermediary involved in there, don't expect that you're going to be making, you know, huge market beating metrics on that, because ultimately there's a professional in there who has a kind of an awareness of what that asset is worth, even though maybe they're almost more working for themselves than they are working to represent the seller or the buyer in that particular situation. So then the next place where you can have these off-market deals will be from wholesalers. And so even though the wholesaling game is less active in Canada than it is in the US, on multifamily things, like, there are still wholesalers who are active. And so the way that this works is those wholesalers will like typically be canvassing, or they'll be just having a very wide net. They've built themselves a prospecting business. And that's going to be the next category that I'm going to talk about in just a couple of minutes. But I want to start with the wholesalers. So like, wholesalers typically will have built this, you know, network of talking to sellers and getting properties under contract to purchase them, whether it's with interesting conditions or just because they have cast a really wide net to find some of those few distressed properties that still exist. They'll get them under contract, and then they will sell that promise to purchase to a group of whatever investors that they know. Now, you know, I've had the opportunity to look at some of those deals that wholesalers, you know, once in a while call me for. And so what are the sort of things that you should expect? Well, the wholesaler obviously will be probably making a handsome fee, because like, I'll give you just an example. So let's say that the property, if it were listed on Centris, would be worth a $1.2 million. Let's say that the wholesaler got it under contract at $1 million. They might wholesale that to you at a, you know, $50,000 discount. So they might wholesale you, and the price that you will pay will be $1.150 million, let's say, on that deal. So you are making a $50,000 savings at the time of purchase. But then what happens is that where the risk is for you as the buyer who is assuming that promise to purchase from the wholesaler is that typically they will ask you for a non-refundable deposit. And like, that makes sense, because let's say they have to, you know, they have this, you know, $1 million deal. So like, they stand to make $150,000 when you purchase that promise to purchase for them. Now, obviously, you know, the seller's making money, you're making money, the wholesaler's making money. So like, I don't have a philosophical problem with the fact that the wholesaler like built their prospecting engine, and that now they're making $100,000 by selling me a discounted deal. That's not a problem. But what I do find is a little bit, you know, difficult maybe to wrap your head around is the fact that you have to give them a non-refundable deposit. And so if that happens, it means that if anything goes wrong with your financing, if the seller acts weird and realizes that they're getting a bad deal when they show up at the notary and see that like, you're paying, you know, $150,000 more than they're getting, and it's the middleman who's keeping the difference. Like, if anything goes wrong with that, your deposit has already been paid directly to the wholesaler, and so you've lost it. And so unless you're getting a really amazing deal and you have great confidence in the wholesaler, you know, that can be a situation that might be a little bit sketchy to get into. But be aware that those things do exist on, you know, out there in the world, and that if this is something that you're interested in, the best thing that you can do is to go out there and try to meet wholesalers who are operating those kind of things and getting some of those deals under contract. And so this then brings me to the prospecting category. And so, like, I do have colleagues who are investors who do like a really high volume of, you know, acquisitions. And what they've done is they've built this prospecting engine. And the way that the prospecting engine tends to work is that they're like canvassing, they're sending letters. So, like, you know, at least twice a week, I come home and I find a letter in my mailbox that, you know, because my name or my company name will be tied to my address. And so then I find some prospector who is telling me that they have interest in my building. And usually they will put in that letter, oh, you know, this is an all cash offer. Give me a call if you're interested. And so then, like, in a funny way, those people who are doing that prospecting are actually my like investor colleagues. And so it is possible to build that kind of a prospecting engine where you are scraping data or purchasing lists online and then putting mailings out to different owners to try to get interest. And from what I know, I do have colleagues who are quite successful with doing that. So that's beyond the scope of obviously this podcast episode, but that is a business model that some people run. And then some of those prospectors do then double as wholesalers, because often they will get more contracts, more properties under contract at a good price than they can actually acquire and manage on their own. So you then have the potential to perhaps buy some of those deals wholesaled from them. And of the, you know, wholesalers with whom I do have a more trust relationship, some of them are those colleagues of mine who have built those prospecting engines to have access to those off-market deals. But now what I will say about some of this, like, you know, direct to seller traffic, is that what you're hoping to do as a person like that who's setting up a prospecting engine is that you're dealing with this whole gamut of probably unprofessional sellers who are looking to liquidate their buildings. And so you have to be aware that as somebody who's trying to go direct to seller, there's going to be a lot more human friction and, you know, dealing with sellers who are perhaps a little bit odd, because the most efficient thing to do as a seller is, if you're looking to liquidate a property, is to list it on market to get yourself the highest possible price. And if you as the prospector or the wholesaler are trying to kind of short circuit that, well, probably the person that you're going to find on the receiving end of that is going to be a human who's special, because people who are less special just list their properties on Centris. So that is something to be aware of. And, you know, I have in my life as a broker at various times represented buyers who have done some of that prospecting. And I found myself in the middle trying to babysit that kind of a transaction. And as a broker, it's always been like an incredible headache, because the seller is, you know, in some way complicating the transaction. And it's not someone who like made a decision and got up one morning and was like, okay, I'm going to sell my building today. They responded to a letter that they got mailed, and any professional investor is going to know what their property is worth. And so you're not going to be getting a crazy deal on that. You're going to be getting the exact same deal you would get on Centris, except without the benefit of being able to do it with an agent in the middle. The only type of person with whom you're going to get a crazy discount is somebody who either the property is for some reason distressed, or because like they're just an unusual human being who's going to be complicated to deal with in a business context, and not a professional landlord with whom you might have a nice kind of transaction. Now, the last place to find off-market deals, which I have found to actually be the most pleasant kind of off-market deals that one can do, is from your network and perhaps seeing buildings or people you know. And in this category, I would put the property manager. And if you have a property manager who does not have a relationship with a real estate broker who immediately handles all their deals, this can be a really great source of those off-market deals, because the property manager is the first person to know when a client wants to offload a building And sometimes they don't even charge a fee as a middleman. It's just because they are shepherding their clients' buildings. This can be a good way to just, you know, transact even in between the portfolio. And so the property manager's axe to grind in there is that if they want to keep a particular building within their investment portfolio, if they can just, you know, transact it from one of their clients to another one of their clients, it means that they get to keep that property, which they probably already know and have already invested time into managing. They get to keep it in their portfolio. So in that respect, it can be, you know, a pretty easy deal to do, and it can be like relatively pleasant. And then perhaps you're saving the brokerage fees. So, you know, those have been some nice transactions that I've had a chance to participate in, which would qualify as off markets. And then the other thing here is to be within, you know, networks of people who are perhaps looking at transacting their own properties, and they, you know, are able to do it off, like off market. And so in that case, it would be the seller talking directly to the buyer, but without that whole process of prospecting and canvassing and all of that stuff, just somebody who wants to liquidate an asset and somebody else who wants to buy it. Now, part of the reason why this doesn't happen more often is that if you're in an investor circle, like I always joke, you know, that when I'm listing a property on Centris, I always joke to my network, like, you don't want to buy a property that I've worked on because it's probably fully optimized by the time I come to sell it, and I expect to sell it for top dollar. So if your network contains a lot of investors, then probably they're going to be liquidating properties in a similar way. And so that's maybe not the best way to make deals. The other thing is that depending on the type of portfolio you're trying to build, perhaps your network just doesn't extend that far. And so if you're looking at to buy, like, you know, a sixplex or a triplex in a specific area of town at a specific metric, what are the chances that someone you know or can get to really owns that kind of an asset and you can convince them to transact it? So like, it's not that that can't happen. It's just that there's a fairly low probability. Now, one of the other places that, like, I have seen off-market things happen in a way that is effective is if you are looking to build a portfolio in a specific neighborhood. So let's say you have your eye on the neighbor's building, or like there's a property down the street that you've been coveting because you think that maybe it would be a good addition to your portfolio, and you're able to talk to the tenants and then like go up the food chain to talk to the owner. Like, I have seen deals like that work effectively. And in terms of my own liquidating of certain properties of mine, I've actually sold one of my properties that way to, you know, a neighbor who was looking to consolidate and purchase the building next door. So, you know, if it's something that stays within the neighborhood, by all means, that's a great source of leads and a great way to do some of those off-market deals. Now, will those deals be done at metrics that are Centris beating? I'm not really sure, because I don't think, like, if you think of how a seller thinks, like, it's never in their interest to liquidate a property of theirs at way below market value. So in reality, the only thing that you are like really hoping to save is going to be some of those brokerage fees. And like, you know, if let's say a particular property is worth $900,000, do you think that the seller is going to sell it to you for 4% less just because there's no broker? I'm not convinced. It's really more a way that like the seller is going to try to save having to pay a broker by liquidating it that way off market. And so ultimately, like, what the seller's trying to do, what their incentive is to sell off market, is to save those brokerage fees. So, you know, that's kind of something just to understand in the way that the off market sphere works, is that you as a buyer who's looking to buy something, like, ultimately, if there is a savings in that situation, it's probably going to be the brokerage fees that are saved by the seller. So for you as the buyer, whether you're buying including broker fees or excluding broker fees because you're talking with the seller directly, chances are that savings is not going to be passed on to you. The only weakness in that model is that, like, instead of being represented by an agent yourself and having that be basically covered by the seller, like, now you're transacting without a broker. And so that's, you know, going to be a potentially less agreeable transaction for you as a buyer. But so now, just to address the very last myth here, which is the fact that there are no good deals left on Centris and all the good deals are done off market. Well, I, you know, want to say that this is, you know, not the truth. I think it will depend on the business model of the investor as to whether or not they buy on market. I would say I do about 80% of my deals purchasing directly off of the MLS. And I find that on that platform, there are sufficient properties that are either badly listed by unprofessional agents or on which you can still do good deals because perhaps you're able to put together a competitive offer, or because there's something buried in the listing that makes it a better deal than what it looks like on market. So I don't think that the doom and gloom to say that there's, you know, the only good market are off markets. Like, there are good deals available off market, but those deals come at a price, and the price will either be dealing with shady brokers in the middle with passing the savings on to the seller, or potentially dealing with a special human being on the other end of that transaction who's just going to make it less streamlined than it would be if it shows up on MLS and there's a listing broker who's at least making some of that process be a little bit more professional. So in a nutshell, that's kind of an overview of the off-market landscape. And hopefully you've gained some insight into how some of those actors work. If you are looking to get into prospecting yourself and canvassing, that's a whole topic for a different time. But my purpose in this episode was really to help you understand that there are good deals that are still available on the MLS, and that when you are doing off-market deals, because there is a high degree of market efficiency, you're not going to be perhaps saving as much as you think. And the access to some of those deals, the gatekeepers to it, are perhaps some unpleasantness, whether, you know, brokers or direct-to-seller interactions, that there is an opportunity cost to that. And so to be aware of the fact that, like, somewhere you're going to be paying for that. And either you'll be paying with your time, you'll be paying with opportunity cost, with unpleasantness, or with dollars. So there's no magic bullet that is going to give you access to amazing deals off market. Unfortunately, that comes either dressed in overalls and looking like work, where you have to build a prospecting engine, or else it just means that you're going to have to deal with some unprofessional people on the line that might make those transactions more complicated for you. So real estate fan, thanks for joining me and listening to this episode. I want to remind you that we're going to be tying all of this, how to do good deals in a competitive market, on our free webinar on June 16th, which you can register for through the equitybuildersclub.com website on the events tab. Or if you are in Montreal, and even if you're not, please come and join us for our next in-person networking event on June 17th at the University Club in Montreal. Also, tickets are available on the equitybuildersclub.com website.
The second exciting thing is that we still have a few more coaching spots available in our next cohort. If you would like to have a little bit more help closing on that next property, please go ahead and fill out the contact form on equitybuildersclub.com, and we would be happy to jump on a call and explain to you a little bit more about what we do.
Thank you for listening to the Real Escape Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Terry Schauer. If you find that this show has been useful to you, if you've enjoyed the content, if it's done anything to move the needle for you, please go ahead and share it with one person who you think could profit from listening to it. Until next time, real estate fans.